my voice is going to work this morning. I want to start by thanking Lily and the worship committee for the opportunity to stand here before you today. At least I think I want to thank her. My work puts me in this pulpit position once in a while, but I have to say that it's dramatically easier to stand up and hold forth about faith and social justice to a crowd of complete strangers, no matter how large, than it is to look from here into the eyes of one's family, friends, and the woman other than Ellen, who my son will soon be harassing about a play date. So bear with me if the mic picks up the sound of my knees knocking together up here. Maybe that'll allow me to get into some sort of rhythm. Can we get our hands on justice? I'm here to speak about the role of social justice in faith communities. I'm also here to say something about Unitarian Universalist Service Committee as a human rights organization that seeks to be a vehicle for Unitarian Universalists and other people of conscience to put our values and faith commitments into practice. I'm going to get to that, but I need to start someplace else for just a minute. I need to start by reflecting on the results of our recent visioning process, which I've appreciated a lot. We've said quite clearly that we want this congregation to offer us a strong sense of community in a world where too many people feel too alone. We want our community to serve as support for our diverse personal spiritual practices, as well as a center for a common spirituality that we will fashion out of whole cloth here together. Finally, we want the spiritual community to be outward as well as inward looking, to recognize that we live in a larger community with great strengths and frightening challenges. We wish to engage with that community and in some small way transform it. And oh yes, we do all this embracing intergenerational and other forms of diversity as the cornerstones of community life. We welcome and we seek. Now, of course, we don't all want all of this equally. Wouldn't it be excruciatingly boring if we did? We will dutifully form committees working to make real various aspects of this vision. There will be fits and starts, and even perish the thought, conflict. As we find the right relationship between the elements of our vision. That's all great, but let us please not forget that it is the totality of that vision that will create energy in this community and in the world. It is that totality that will liberate us from a scarcity view of what we can achieve together. Only that larger vision can deliver us from the dreaded syndrome of open calendar envy. Who says that energy can neither be created nor destroyed? And who will join Michelle and Jeremy on the totality of the vision committee? With that on the table, one can more comfortably slip into the role of bulker agitator. As I said before, I work at UUSC, and I need your help for a second in answering a quick question for me, which is if somebody was new here and said to you, coffee hour or someplace out here, what is that UUSC thing with little boxes? How many feel like you could give an answer to that question of some form? Good. Thank you. That's helpful. If you know UUSC no other way, then you may know it by the colorful boxes that appear here each November to introduce the Guest at Your Table program, which this community supports with uncommon generosity. UUSC exists because an interest in human rights and social justice is common to almost all UU congregations. And since 1940, UUSC has been seen as one vehicle for the expression of that interest. We do three things. And very quickly, I'll say those three things. One is we build partnerships, which is relationships with other like-minded organizations who also want to see the same sort of changes that we want to see. That's out of the belief that really change over time only happens based on those kinds of relationships of mutual trust and reciprocity. And the support that goes through those partnerships can be material, moral, all different kinds of support. From those partnerships and that work, we learn something. The second thing we do is education, which is to say to anybody who will listen and lots of people who've never intended to listen, what it is that we've learned from those experiences. The final thing is advocacy, which is based on that learning experience, we want to change something, whether it's the policies of our government or whatever it is, we want to make change in the world based on what we've learned. I have to tell you something about the creation myth of UUSC. First of all, because I'm Irish, it can't resist a great story. But also because the story speaks to social action as an essential part of our identity as UUs. Since people who worship right here in this building were part of the formation of UUSC, it's also part of our own history here in some way. The service committee's roots extend back to 1939, when the American Unitarian Association sent a young minister and his wife, Waite Still and Martha Sharp, from Wellesley, Mass. To Prague, Czechoslovakia, to serve political dissidents and Jewish refugees fleeing for their lives as Nazi terror enveloped first Germany, then Austria, and finally the Sudetenland. The Sharps left their two young children in the outstretched hands of their congregation and ventured forth into a dangerous situation that was completely unknown to them. The enormity of the commitment is not entirely abstract for me. When I went to work for the service committee, my two children were almost exactly the same ages as the two Sharp children were in 1939, even on those most trying days when my failure as a parent is most evident. I can't imagine doing what the Sharps did at that time. But to really understand that commitment, we must remember a little something about our nation in 1939. While the worst of the Great Depression was behind us, the U.S. economy is still not recovered. The extreme anti-Semitism of the Nazis that would give rise to the Holocaust was on display for anyone who wished to see it. But isolationism was still a key pillar of U.S. foreign policy, and very few in this country were urging direct involvement in what was seen as a European problem. And that isolationism was tinged with more than a little of our own xenophobia, as evidenced by the late 1930s popularity of people like Father Coughlin, the rabid right-wing radio evangelist. I mention him because I know he had a particular influence on my own parents at that time. Imagine what it meant in that context to decide to leave one's life behind to undertake refugee relief work in Czechoslovakia. By comparison, someone who today believes, as I do, that the U.S. should immediately withdraw from Iraq certainly holds a mainstream view. A few weeks after the Sharps arrived in Europe, the Nazis invaded Czechoslovakia. Ignoring all advice from home, the Sharps stayed. When the Nazis closed their office and threw their furniture into the streets, they still didn't leave. Stubborn people, these Unitarians. Fully 6 months after the invasion, it became clear to the Sharps that their work had put them directly into the path of the Gestapo. Finally acknowledging the extreme danger, they returned home, having helped hundreds of desperate people to leave Czechoslovakia, and having helped feed thousands more. But their experience with Europe's refugees had affected the Sharps profoundly, and they still felt a strong need to respond to a building crisis. In May 1940, the Sharps returned to the fray, representing the newly formed Unitarian Service Committee, the precursor of what is now UUSC. They set up shop in Lisbon, Portugal, and for the duration of the war, operated a variety of service programs in a kind of underground railroad between Marseille and Lisbon. That network rescued men, women, and children in large numbers, including the famed artist Marc Chagall. The Sharps and their Unitarian colleagues, there are five we consider the founders of the service committee, focused their effort on political refugees, because the first to stand up to the Nazis were often socialists, communists, or trade unionists, many of them Jews. Relief organizations often steered clear of such people because of the potential cost of being associated with them. That steering clear still happens in humanitarian relief today. You may be interested to know that the service committee founded by the Sharps adopted the flaming chalice as its official seal on April 1st, 1941. The artwork for this logo was commissioned from Hans Deutsch, a Jewish artist from Paris, and a refugee who worked in the Lisbon office of the USC for several months before immigrating to the United States. Over time, the flaming chalice became a symbol of safety and hope to refugees throughout Europe. The sight of someone discreetly wearing that symbol meant simply that the refugee was in a safe place. When the Unitarian and Universalist denominations merged in 1961, the flaming chalice became the symbol of Unitarian Universalism, as it is still today. The story of the Sharps and other founders of the USC is the stuff of feature films. And indeed, Hollywood is seriously considering just such a script. Watch for Meryl Streep, probably not Mel Gibson. It's easy to draw the sharks as larger-than-life figures, and they did indeed take extraordinary steps at a moment when too many were silent. And yet the fact that they did so means that others could have done it, that anyone in this room could have done it, that it was not beyond the bounds of the human imagination. If even one person in a generation makes a moral choice, it leaves the rest of us with less excuse to remain silent before our own ethical dilemmas. We as a society need such bearers of moral alarm. We need prophetic voices. That's what the sharks did for all of us. Before they or the world knew there was a Holocaust, Wade Still and Martha Sharp saw human suffering and knew people were in danger. They didn't ask, will we succeed or what will we accomplish? They ignored risk to their own safety and did what they could in the face of overwhelming odds, living out their belief in the worth and dignity of every person. In 1963, the Israeli Holocaust Memorial Yad Vashem embarked upon a worldwide project to identify non-Jews who would risk their own lives to consciously save individual Jews from the Holocaust. Upon locating such people, Yad Vashem grants them the title Righteous Among the Nations. To date, more than 21,000 people from around the world have been afforded this special status, but only one of them, a man named Varian Fry, was a U.S. citizen at the time he performed the righteous deed. Think about that. One out of 21,000. This is a story that needs to be told, and we're going to tell it. So, can we get our hands on justice? How did the sharks see what they were doing in 1939? In making their quite inspiring choices, they did something with deep roots in Unitarian Universalism that are still evident today. They saw a problem and did what they needed to put their hands on. In this congregation, and in almost every UU congregation that I know of, people put their hands on problems every day. We're quite good at organizing service projects that get food to the Boston Food Bank, help out at the Food Project, or provide holiday gifts to kids who might not otherwise receive. This is important work that has an impact on our community and also gives us a sense that we, as a congregation, are serving those in need. But there are other ways to get our hands on problems in the community as well. For at least the last 2 years, the Greater Boston Interfaith Organization has been engaged with many others in a struggle to increase access to health care in Massachusetts. Congregations across a wide range of denominations have contributed, morally and materially, to a campaign that just this past week resulted in the adoption of a novel approach to regulating access to health insurance in the Commonwealth. I should say novel and controversial. It remains to be seen whether or not this bold approach will deliver the promised results. But this is clearly an example of churches putting hands and hearts to a problem, and together with others, getting results. You're probably aware of the slow-motion genocide occurring in the Sudanese region of Darfur. As many as 400,000 people have already died in a conflagration that our government has publicly recognized as genocide. Unfortunately, recognizing genocide in Darfur does not seem to have created in our leaders the requisite sense of urgency to act to end the violence. Many organizations have focused on humanitarian aid to Darfur, which I consider important work that is extremely dangerous for those doing it. UUSC is also providing aid to Darfuri refugees in camps in Chad, with a focus on the problem of sexual violence in and around those camps. Our members have also asked that we find other ways for them to put their hands and hearts directly to this problem. To this end, we've involved congregations all over the country in the Million Voices for Darfur campaign. Along with many other organizations, we're asking our members to sign postcards to President Bush, asking that he take action to end the violence in Darfur. We're asking those who can join us at rallies in Washington, D.C. and San Francisco on April 30th to do so. On May 1st, we'll deliver all the million cards to the president. No small feat, I may add, either collecting or delivering the million cards. So yes, there's more than one way to get one's hands on a problem. UUSC and GBIO are only two of the many avenues available for congregational involvement in this sort of social justice work. Thankfully, there are innumerable examples in a long history of congregations, including UU congregations, who have made social justice organizing an important part of the life of their community. There's no need to reinvent that wheel. Not surprisingly, the most successful are those that build that work upon a successful, long-term effort to build a strong spiritual community. Just last week, I had the opportunity to visit one such congregation, the First Church Unitarian Universalist of Portland, Oregon. People had to tell me over and over how to say Oregon instead of Oregon, as I was determined to do. A week ago Friday, the day I arrived in Portland, the First Church hosted a benefit concert with Holly Near, to which they sold 2,000 tickets. The proceeds of the concert will go to support an inner-city summer arts camp that the church had taken over when budget cuts forced local government to close the camp. The congregation has grown tremendously in the past decade, and its senior minister attributes much of that growth to the prophetic presence of the church in its community. The First Church of Portland is certainly in a unique situation, but I think that Reverend Marilyn Sewell's reflection on her own church is relevant for any UU church seeking its way forward. Here's a bit of a snippet of that reflection. Let's think about our church for a moment. Again, she's talking about her church in Portland. We didn't set a goal like, let's become the largest Unitarian Universalist church in the nation. Not at all. In fact, I remember being asked right after I was called to this church, what are your goals for the church, Marilyn? And I said, I don't have any goals. I just want to know the people, get to know the people, and see what they want. But guess what happened? The demographics of Portland changed, and along came ballot measure 7, and we took a very public stand on that. I'm sorry, ballot measure 9. Shows I don't know much about the ballot measure. And then there was the issue of the urban growth boundary. And then there was the spiritual evolution of the baby boomers. And other factors all conspired to lead us to where we are today. 1,600 members, undergoing another growth spurt, getting ready now to build the Elliott Center, which will move us into a whole new era in terms of our ability to give witness to our liberal values in this community. We're a beacon church for Unitarian Universalism, not just in the Northwest, but for the whole nation. So much more. Indeed, there are many people out there ready to help the UU Church, wishing to discover how to give witness to its values and its community. The challenges of doing so in 2006 in West Roxbury, Massachusetts are many. They are daunting, and they're known to us all. But the answer to the question is yes. If we're willing to get them dirty, we can indeed get our hands on justice. I'll end today, as I often do, with a short passage from the Talmud that I find to be a source of inspiration for my work, and I hope you find it the same. Do not be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief. Do justly now. Walk humbly now. Love mercy now. You're not obligated to complete